The things I remember about this model that I worked on, the designer, by the way, was Cousins. His name was Cousins. And his name is in that article on the Mercury, the list of people that were at the design center when those all of those vehicles were done in 1938. Anyway, this model had the grill from Cousins, which was this. It was reproduced in this issue of the Ford Times, this one here.
And can you describe that grill in terms of the
yes, it,
shape and form?
It had a heavy bumper similar to what was used later in the 50s, 60s. And it had a central like nose piece that came up out of the bumper as a guard, a large guard.
Mm-hmm.
And here we go.
Mm-hmm. Oh, yes.
And so this was a development out of this sketch.
Mm-hmm. Cousins was a staff designer or illustrator at Ford?
Yes. The list of employees doesn't exactly give their position, you know. It lists some of the positions and it lists others as working there at the time, doing various things. Well, he was on the board, and he was an artist and illustrator, and he did a variety of rather nice designs, I thought, at the time. John Nager was also on the board, and I need that list of people.
Mm-hmm. We mentioned Benny Barbera.
Benny Barbera was a modeler. He had come through the trade school,
mm-hmm.
and at the time I came in, he had just gone into the service.
Mm-hmm.
And one of the early ones
mm-hmm.
had gone into service.
How about Ed Martin? Was he there?
Ed Martin was there, yes. I think most all of the others were there. There were maybe three that had gone into service, three fellows that I never met, some of them.
Apparently Ed Martin had worked on the Continental, had he not, with them?
So I understand,
Bob
yes.
Gregory.
Yes. Gregory would come around, of course. Edsel Ford would come in. Henry Ford, the only time I recall seeing Henry Ford was a period of time I was working on this model. And this was probably in January after the war had started. And there was a bench along this partition that partitioned off the design department from the rest of the engineering lab. And he and Edsel came in, and they sat down on this bench behind this model, and they must have been there for an hour discussing their various problems, I presume.
Not discussing the model, though.
Not discussing the model. this model, this particular model, was an experimental model, really. They were trying out various ideas as far as highlights were concerned.
Mm-hmm.
And it was difficult to see highlights. For instance, in this photograph,
mm-hmm.
you see form, but you don't see any highlights. The only way you could see highlights would be to get in a position that would permit you to get a proper reflection of lights, probably from the windows.
Mm-hmm. You didn't put up artificial lights, did you?
Well, they tried various things, but at that time, what they had for light was were principally in the daytime they had the windows in the roof,
mm-hmm.
and they had the roll-up shutters, which you may remember,
mm-hmm.
and so when you had a gray day, why, they would have shutters open at both sides of these windows in the roof. On sunny days, they would have the eastern side shut and the west side open in the afternoons, they'd shut the west side and open up the eastern side if it was, you know, warm.
Mm-hmm.
So you got good light from the roof, from these V ceiling windows.
Mm-hmm.
I guess they must have had fluorescent lights in that building.
Mm-hmm. Right.
So we had that. Of course, this would have been strings of light. But I remember Beinecke trying different things. And I remember people telling me, perhaps this fellow John Coleman, which I'll mention in a moment, about some of the experiments the GM was doing. They brought in a great big bulb at one time, tried to light the whole area. And about the only thing it did was to melt the clay, I was told. But
incidentally, at this point, where were you getting your clay from? Was it
this was from Chauvin's.
Just Chauvin was the pretty much the sole supplier.
Yes.
Mm-hmm.
They had the green clay at that time, mm-hmm. and we had I suppose. Maybe at least three full-size models going, something like that. And so they had a fair amount of clay there.
Can you describe how it was shipped and how you got it into a malleable form to use?
Yes, the clay was shipped at that time very similar to what it is now. It was shipped in billets, in cardboard boxes. They had clay. Yeah, the boxes now, and I think probably at that time, are very similar. Hold 62 pounds of clay,
mm-hmm.
and the billets come in various sizes and shapes, whatever you want.
Mm-hmm.
In fact, the boxes, depending upon the type of billet and the size of the billet, they do have different boxes, so the clay could come different weights, maybe mm-hmm. 50 pounds to 60-some pounds.
Mm-hmm.
But they had a clay oven that had, I believe, it was a double set of drawers side by side in one oven,
mm-hmm.
and it could have been three drawers on each side or two drawers on each side.
Mm-hmm.
So each oven, and they must have had at least two of these, held either six drawers or four drawers each.
Mm-hmm.
And the way that they heated the clay was from light bulbs in the bottom of the oven.
Oh, high intensity light bulb.
Well, they had a series of, I think, 150 or 200 watt bulbs.
Really?
And the clay needs to be heated to, well, let's say, depending upon the type of clay, from 110 to 140 degrees.
Uh-huh.
So the light bulbs did a very fine job. Of course, you're wasting light, and you were wasting electricity too.
Uh-huh.
But it heated very evenly, did a good job.
I somehow would have thought they would have used some sort of electric coils.
Well, they did later, but of course one of the problems with the types of ovens that were developed later is that they can be turned up, or something can go wrong with controls, they can overheat.
Oh, I see.
And
so this was a control.
Somebody wants some hot clay in a hurry, and they turn it up, and then you get a lot of soup. You get the clay too hot, it breaks down.
Mm-hmm.
And in fact, clay is composed of 60% sulfur and 30% oils and waxes, mostly wax.
Mostly wax, rather.
Well, a combination of oil and wax.
Mm-hmm.
And 10% actual clay.
Why the sulfur? What?
Well, you need a filler.
It was a filler.
Mm-hmm.
And a binder, perhaps.
And a binder,
nice.
Right.
Okay.
And you get it up to 200 degrees, and the sulfur starts coming off. And while this isn't deadly, you get sulfur fumes in a room. It'll knock the people out.
Mm-hmm.
So it is dangerous. But anyway, the light bulbs work quite fine.
Mm-hmm.
And they had an extrusion machine, a small extrusion machine, that worked off of a worm, electric motor, and a belt pulley.
In other words, you could make the forms that you wanted.
Yes.
I mean, the
so it had an electric motor with a large wheel,
mm-hmm.
and a was in effect geared down to run very slowly with a small wheel on the worm drive, so that the worm had a very small pitch, and it would run slow enough so that it could extrude clay. So you could extrude some moldings. And
forgive me. This must have been quite a departure for you at this point. You've not done much molding, modeling, or working with clay.
No, not actually. I had built this wood model.
Mm-hmm.
I had worked in various things in wood. You know, I had had 3 years of wood in junior high. I had this small amount of clay, a plastiline type clay, and so I had made some various parts of cars. I didn't have enough to make a full model. And I had no intention of becoming a modeler, you know,
right.
I hadn't mentioned, but they saw that I could make a model and I understood form and highlight, so they needed help. They needed help on the model, so that's what I was put on.
Mm-hmm.
I was put with the fellow that I would have considered, the young fellow that I would have considered the best of their modelers. He later left and went into engineering, and later became an executive engineer at the time of his retirement here a few years ago. What's his name? Bud Eugene, I always called him Gene. I'll have to come. That's why I need this list of employees. Adams, Gene
Bud
Adams.
Sure.
Bud Adams.
Sure, right.
Uh-huh. He was quite good.
Mm-hmm.
And I worked with him. He was the first fellow I worked with on the first model.
You were, in a sense, an apprentice.
An apprentice to him, yes.
Mm-hmm.
And then I worked, we started this full model together. So I learned the mechanics of doing, you know, they had sets of sweeps. I would say it was at that time, 1940, 41, they were quite sophisticated, much more so than the rest of the industry.
Did you say sets and sweeps?
Sets of sweeps.
Now what does that mean?
Well, a sweep is a part of an arc. And you have sets of these, you can get them different lengths, but the size you normally work with in full-size modeling are sets of sweeps that are 60 inches long. They look like a straight edge, except they're a curve,
mm-hmm.
a constant curve.
Mm-hmm.
And sweeps are numbered, so that a number one sweep has an arc that has a 1/8 of an inch rise in the 60-inch length.
Mm-hmm.
A number two has 2/8, a number three, 3/8, and so forth. So
these are used as basis for the modeling procedure.
There are areas of the car where you can, for instance, the roof, you may vary the sweep from front to rear, or mm-hmm. as you approach the front or rear to some extent, but through a major portion of it, it may be constant sweep.
Mm-hmm.
It may be also that using a constant sweep, you never get a good form. It never looks right. So after you've worked it in with a sweep, you'll take some of the center out to flatten it.
Mm-hmm.
Otherwise, it looks like it has a bump in it. But
you think these were the most sophisticated in the industry at the time?
Well, from
what you observed.
From what I observed and the knowledge I had of other operations, Ford, this was always Ford's effort, you know, to build up operations that would be the epitome of the best thing around at the time.
How do you think that came about? Was that Gregory? Was it Wagner?
I think the group of people they had together.
Just a really sharp and forward-looking group.
And probably the emphasis that Edsel gave it,
mm-hmm.
The products,
certainly
again, yes, the products that were developed by this group in the late 30s
mm-hmm.
were probably the best designs, the best lasting designs of the period.
Mm-hmm.
While they did not create the best sales, this was had much to do with other things, such as lack of hydraulic brakes.
Yes, right.
And lack of independent suspension development, right. You know, and other things.
All those things that Edsel and Henry battled about over the decades.
That's
years.
Correct. And of course, this department broke down. Their new models, the 41 Ford Mercury, was a regression, which is hardly understandable. I don't understand how they even could have come out with those vehicles. After
really?
Coming out with the things that they did themselves. They did the Lincoln, the 38 Lincoln Zephyr,
mm-hmm.
the new front end sheet metal and grille, which is still one of the best forms and designs.
Yeah.
The entire Mercury.
Mm-hmm.
The 39-40 Fords were very nice.
Mm-hmm.
Nothing wrong with them, really.
No.
And then to come out with what they did in 41, it just isn't understandable.
Mm.
But somehow the influence of certain people and perhaps the efforts by manufacturing to simplify forms and to cater to manufacturing wishes, and perhaps Edsel's illness
mm-hmm.
could have played a major part in those developments.
Mm-hmm.
Anyway, so I went in there and just, you know, just amazed by what was there, although I didn't like some of the things I saw, and at that point of time I was really wishing to go to GM and hire in, because this was the outstanding place to work.
Was Emil Zorlein's shop
Zorlein
close
was,
to your area?
Yes, he was there.
Mm-hmm.
Yes.
Sort of the master, legendary master mechanic.
I guess you could say that, right.
Yes. Mm-hmm.
And of course, Henry spent most of his time in the other parts of the building. The only one time that I really remember him in is that time in January of 42. Said 41, January of 42,
mm-hmm.
when he and Edsel came in and they sat down behind the model for this hour period.
Mm-hmm.
But Edsel would come in and look at the models, and of course every day all of the major, I'm not sure they were called vice presidents at that time or not.
There was only one, Pete Martin.
Pete Martin.
And Charlie Sorensen yes. got one during the war.
Okay.
Well, but certainly, they were executives.
The top executives always had lunch over there at the round, so-called round table.
Mm-hmm. Now, where was that located?
Well, they had their dining room. It was in a separate building. The back of the building was a garage.
Mm-hmm.
The front of the building was just opposite the power plant
mm-hmm.
and was on the corner.
Mm-hmm.
And they had a covered breezeway hallway, I guess you'd call, running from the engineering lab over to this building.
Mm-hmm.
So the back part was all a garage, and these hallway went through, and the front part they had a cafeteria, and in the corner itself they had the dining room where they had the
mm-hmm.
round table.
Right. This was the engineering laboratory on Oakwood Boulevard.
That's correct. Mm-hmm. And this corner was the corner of the road that runs out to Michigan Avenue.
Oh, yes.
And where the powerhouse was. The powerhouse is here, and this building is here. The building is still there.
Mm-hmm.
But in the meantime, they built, they used to have the garden there. They would grow the vegetables for the dining room, the cafeteria.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
But they covered that all over, and
that's been subsumed by the addition that they
built an addition there for design.
Mm-hmm. They had lovely twin ponds out
twin
in front.
Twin ponds, yes. It was a beautiful
stroll
spot.
Out there during your lunch hour.
Yeah, right. And then they covered over one of those, filled it and covered it for a parking lot.
Mm-hmm.
Of course, back in those days, they had the elevator, the crane elevator.
Was it still there on the corner?
Yeah.
Of the
sure, that was there until not too many years ago.
Mm-hmm.
And
of course,
in the 60s, they took it down.
Just a stone's throw away was Greenfield Village and Henry
sure.
Ford Museum.
Right, it was all there.
Mm-hmm.
Well, anyway, the top executives would always eat lunch there at the round table and have their discussions, and about 1:30 or so, or 2 o'clock, they would come strolling down through the lab, and they would go down through design, mm-hmm. and go out the south end of the building, and they would have parked out mm-hmm. there. They'd
right.
get in the cars and drive away.
Right.
So almost every day, some of those fellows would be coming through there, you know. Mm-hmm. And so they, the top executives had a pretty good idea of what was going on in design. Sorensen didn't come through very often. I can remember one time.
This is Charles Sorensen.
Charles Sorensen. I believe it was his name, Koot. What was it? K-R-U-T-H or something like that.
Mm-hmm. Right.
He came around and he said Sorensen's coming through to review the models, and please get your badges out on your smocks. We wore smocks.
Mm-hmm. Right.
I always wore my own. They had their own smocks, but I had my wife make mine.
Oh, okay.
So you'd have them on your shirt maybe, you know, or in your pocket or something.
Yeah.
So he wanted them out on your heart. And he said if it's not out there, he might fire you. So anyway,
Krue, K-R-U-K-E. Yeah.
Okay,
yeah.
K-R-U-K-E. Mm-hmm. All right.
Was he one of the supervisors?
He yeah, and I'm not sure now of what his position was. He was sort of one of Gregory's right hand men,
mm-hmm.
and he may have been involved with interiors, and he was sort of a coordinator. He seemed to make things work.
Mm-hmm.
Very nice person.
Mm-hmm.
And seemed to be very capable. Very friendly sort of fellow.
Mm-hmm.
So, anyway, Sorensen would come around occasionally. And Edsel would come around occasionally. Edsel wouldn't come there all the time either. He would be there occasionally. And Gregory would bring him around. But, well, anyway, we were working on this model and developing various ideas.
Rather distinctive for the time, is it not?
Yeah, it was the new theme.
In what way was it the new theme?
Well, flush sides.
Mm-hmm.
And the running of fenders
directly
into the body. And we tried a lot of things. This was just one of the themes that was developed.
The front end that you mentioned earlier is quite distinctive.
Yeah, it's quite unusual.
Can you describe that in some detail?
Well, it had
This is the 43 prototype.
Right, it would have been a 43 prototype. It had a two-layer bumper and an opening in the bumper at the sides of the center. The center had a like a frame around where the license plate would be.
Mm-hmm.
The top of this frame had a large bumper guard so that the bumper would not have guards other than this. And since it was a tall bumper, that is two layer, it would not need other bumper guards, it was felt. This large central guard came up into the grill and was surrounded by a molding that went out to the sides of the vehicle and on down the sides of the vehicle. This formed then an opening, and of which there was a detailed crosshatch texture.
Mm-hmm.
At the sides of that were parking lights, and to the outside then the fenders were the headlights. One was a normal type of sealed beam. The other was a covered headlight.
Mm-hmm.
And of course that flowed nicely into the fender.
How would that have opened up?
Well, it would have been a door open. The headlight would have been fixed.
Okay.
The cord opened by moving the light,
right.
moving the cover out of the way. However, DeSoto had a grill in 42
mm-hmm.
that had covered headlights,
mm-hmm.
which the door opened up to fixed headlights.
Mm-hmm.
So, The 42 DeSoto at this time wasn't out, but I suppose people may have seen it, I don't know.
Mm-hmm.
Anyway,
yes.
People were working on those types of things at
mm-hmm.
that time.
Yeah. Was that crosshatch distinctive for the time? the grill?
Well, it followed, I suppose, Cadillac theme.
Yeah, Cadillac had done that.
Yes,
that's right.
Cadillac was using a crosshatch grill.
That's fascinating. And unfortunately, never came to fruition.
Well, not really, not that one. The department, as I mentioned, had, as I recall, about 46 people in it, including this fellow Frank Francis, who was the, you might say, secretary administrator. I guess you could call him administrator. And there was another young fellow.
Under Gregory. Mm-hmm, yeah.
And they had a another young fellow there that I think had also come out of trade school. They tried to give good trade school students an opportunity there, is what they did, of course, as John Major did,
right.
I know.
Mm-hmm.
This other fellow was also working in the office. They didn't have any girls, and he was a typist, and he was, I guess you could call, a secretary.
Mm-hmm.
Frank Francis was the administrator, and they had the interior group and developing fabrics and interior settings, and working principally at that point in time with actual sheet metal vehicles, and working on what might have been the 43 model. The 42s were there too, standing.
Mm-hmm.
Ready to go. The interior was on the east side of the building. The designers were along the south west side of the building. The Gregory's office was right by the large doors, enclosed office, glass enclosed office, a double office really, an outer and an inner. His was an inner office, but it was a glass enclosure, both
mm-hmm.
of them.
Mm-hmm.
And his administrator, Frank Francis, and the secretary, this other young fellow, was in this outer office, just to the east of the large doors at the south end of the building.
Mm-hmm.
The shop area was along the west, northwest side of the building. And they had some of the trim development work going on there. And they had a metal shop and wood shop right in that area. And they had these fellows that did plaster work. They make plaster molds and casts of various things.
Mm-hmm.
They did that work there, right on the right on the maple floor.
Mm. Yeah.
But the place was spotless.
Mm-hmm.
And they had two fellas. They had a fellow that was a sweeper.
Mm-hmm.
And he later became a metal worker and worked in the metal shop and eventually retired. The fellow that kept the clay ovens eventually went into the shop and worked, I think, in the plastics department. And I'm not sure, he may have retired by now, but he was still there when I retired.
Mm.
So, really, the time I retired, the only two people that were still there, three people that were there when I hired in, was John Major, Benny Barbera, and this other fellow that had kept the clay ovens. I can think of his name right off. So, the place, as I say, was spotless. They kept the clay all picked up and all nice and clean. And you never had to worry about anything. Benike kept track of the tools. He handed out, some of the tools were given out to you.
Mm-hmm.
Wire
modeling
tools, the larger tools, knives, and some of the larger scrapers,
mm-hmm.
and steel scrapers.
Mm-hmm.
The wire tools and some of these things, the plastic tools, things you could make or would make yourself, those were your own property.
Mm-hmm.
So this was...
Quite an operation.
It was quite an operation, really. It was a nice size. It was like a studio, you know, mm-hmm. the size of a studio. And it wouldn't be unusual to have 45, 50 people in a studio.
What kind of ventilation did you have these days? Simply open
Well,
the
heating,
windows.
Yeah, heating was from radiators around the building. Mm-hmm. And I can't remember that they had any particular central ventilation.
I doubt it, yeah.
Yeah, I don't
Did
remember.
You have any effluent that would have to be sucked out of any kind?
Well, clay has an odor, of course, and you the sulfur odor, and you
yes.
can't disguise it. There's no way you go yeah. into a studio and you're going to smell it.
Yeah.
And even though we have a ventilation system, unless you have clay ovens in a separate room and ventilate it separately, mm-hmm. Even then you'd get some odor off the clay models.
Was this awkward in terms of your respiratory system after prolonged exposure?
I've never known of anyone having difficulty with clay other than there have been a few people, and by few I mean like two or three over the entire period of time that I was in it had any difficulty, and that was the we were talking about clay and problems that people might have had with clay. I was never aware of anyone having any difficulty lung problems with clay.
Mm-hmm.
The only problems you might have had working around models or modelers where people smoking, but smoke inhalation.
You had no problem.
I don't think the clay could have did any problem, except there were a few people, and very, very few, who had cases of eczema on their hands, and they'd
be allergic to something in the clay, obviously.
They would claim this, and whether it was true or not, I don't know. And it could have been the clay. It could have been something in the clay, dirt or something that was not a part of the original clay.
Mm-hmm.
But no, clay was never really a problem to work with
yeah.
as far as health reasons.
You say smoking could it have been ignited had
no well not really but a lot of the fellows smoked you know they didn't allow smoking the old man didn't allow smoking
Henry Ford was deaf against smoking.
And so smoking wasn't permitted until after Henry Ford II came on the scene
mm-hmm.
and after that time of course why there was smoking around models, and this was always a problem because cigarette butts would get occasionally into the clay. And,
yeah. Oh, I think you've never smoked.
No, along with other things, and mm-hmm. so this was a problem.
That must have been. probably a long-standing feud between the modelers and the and the other people.
Yes, it was.
I bet it was. Yeah, right. Stay out of, keep that junk out of our clay.
It's always been a problem keeping the clay clean,
mm-hmm.
and we'll eventually get into developments of clay and some of the problems that surfaced at that time and some of the things we tried to do. And one was, it's probably not possible or economically feasible to clean the clay.
Oh.
It's like the example I use, if you were making models out of wood, you're going to have wood chips.
Mm-hmm.
If you're painting pictures, you're using paint, and you use the paint up, and some of it gets on the floor or the mat you've got laid down. And same thing with clay. So you're going to have, eventually, the clay is going to be used up. And it's cheaper to buy new fresh clay and to use that than trying to scrape up this dirty stuff and clean it.
Mm-hmm.
Well, anyway, design department, which is what it was known as when I hired in.
Circa 1941.
Yeah, up until Well, eventually it was called styling, and then sometime later they changed the name back to design and design center. But the design department had this breakdown of these various areas of interior developments, trim, exterior design. Rigetko was there, of course, in charge of all of the
Martin Rigetko
in charge of all the engineering developments, the surface layouts mm-hmm. that were made, and we had a good shop and a shop foreman. His name slips my mind. Anyway, they had a good shop and some very talented people there. Two of the people that were in the shop when I hired in, one was John Hay, who eventually became the supervisor of the metal shop.
H-A-Y.
H-A-Y. And he's still around as far as I know. He might be an interesting person for you to talk to.
Mm-hmm.
He also came from Ohio. And another was Larry Wilson, whom I mentioned just died 2 weeks ago.
Yeah.
And he was quite a exceptional craftsman. Both of these fellows were.
Mm-hmm.
Larry was more inclined as a an artist, craftsman. And I think Johnny Hay was more inclined as a fabricator of parts.
Mm-hmm.
Larry eventually became a clay modeler and did many of the special advanced models for both Gil Spear and Alex Tremulous when they had those advanced studios that these fellows were in. So they were there, and at the time when I hired in, they were both in metal shop. And although Larry, I know, at that time had worked from time to time in clay, and eventually went into clay totally. And they had some plaster people, of course, and the principal modelers that they had come from plaster. Dick Benike had been a plaster ornament plaster model maker, as well as Bill Leverins. They were both noted in this type of work, and they had a couple of others also that were involved in this. But Gregory, as you mentioned earlier, would make these quick sketches, and these would, you'd see them around at any of the designs, and they were pretty good, because with just a very simple quick sketch with, I think, maybe colored pencil, he would interpret an idea and give his design and modeling people a chance to work on those things. Of course, he would do these for Edsel or whomever else might be in that he would be showing designs to. One of the stories, I don't recall this, but I remember this being told by somebody. He was working on one of these sketches and was showing a design to Edsel, and he was down at least on one knee on the floor, Gregory was, and talking about this design and the flow of the form of the body and so forth, and he asked Edsel, come down here and take a look at this. And Edsel said, I usually don't look at designs from that level.
that's a good story.
And so anyway,
what type of man was Gregory? Did you come in frequent contact with him?
Well, the thing that that Gregory, in his sketches, he would always end up with something that would look like the Continental.
Mm-hmm.
And so
his great creation,
his thing that he was quite involved with. The other thing that he was always noted for, of course, was sketching boats and his interest in boats. Mm-hmm. So it'd
be a marine designer, or at least a marine worker in marine shapes and forms.
Yes, I'm not sure just what his background is in that, but he had been involved in boat construction and had an understanding of that. So it wouldn't be unusual to see a boat in one of his sketches, too. But I can remember that many of his sketches would end up looking like a continental. And, well, some of the developments you ask about the bridge development.
Yes.
I seem to recall, and I would have to look this up, but I seem to recall seeing in the 36 chord reviews of that development, a scale modeling bridge on a board. The chord was developed in scale and was blown up into a full-size form. And so I suppose a bridge may have been used, as you also said, Gregory suggested, in boat building.
Shaping the inverted hull.
Yes, you need some system to symmetrize the two sides of whatever you're building to check the dimensions over so the two sides are close. Mm-hmm. And a bridge is sort of an ideal way of doing this. The bridges that were at design department when I hired in, they had two type. One was an aluminum structure constructed of aluminum angles and channels and I guess riveted together. Mm-hmm. And these were used for years and years, and there must have been maybe I don't know, five of those perhaps, and they had maybe I don't know, two, three others that were constructed, as I recall, perhaps out of wood, out of maybe plywood. Mm-hmm. I don't recall for sure what they were constructed of. I think they were painted aluminum. They had some aluminum parts on them also. And these ran on rails, and the rails, I believe, were... I like the one of the photographs here. The rails of the later bridge, the aluminum channel and angle, ran on aluminum rails that had aluminum structure and holes drilled every inch so that you could stop the bridge on every inch fore and aft and lock it in place. The earlier ones...
Yes,
the earlier ones had rails that were wood,
mm-hmm.
and the bridge, of course, ran on wheels.
Mm-hmm.
On these wood, on steel angles that were attached to the wood rails.
Mm-hmm.
And those bridges, I don't know, they passed out of existence perhaps in the 60s.
I guess at this point it would be instructive to give us a semi-technical explanation of what a bridge did.
All right. The whole development of a design, let's go to that a little bit.
Mm-hmm.
You wanted to develop a new design, let's say at that time a 43. You start with sketches.
Mm-hmm.
And the same thing is done today. So the classic way of doing a design really hasn't changed. Materials and methods and equipment has changed to some extent, but the steps involved are still very similar.
Mm-hmm.
You start with sketches. You obtain information from whomever controls the package. And
from the engineering package.
The engineering package, but you have product people.
Mm-hmm,
they call
true.
Them product
yeah.
planners now.
Mm-hmm.
And division people, and they have their ideas. So all of these ideas have to come together and meld into a configuration. Mm-hmm. So you've got engineers developing something, and you've got design people that are running free mind mm-hmm. in developing shapes and ideas. Mm-hmm. These eventually come together in a layout, you might say, and this today can be used on a computer graphics tube or a table, drafting table, and either plotted out with a plotter or manually laid out a package that will incorporate these sizes. Now, what happens in design many times is the designer is given a layout that has these particular dimensional configurations on it, and some position that the engineer feels the windshield should be in, and side windows, and wheels, and so forth, and floor relative to those dimensions. And the designer has a copy of this, and let's say a full size, and he does a blackboard drawing. So he puts this up and on what they call a blackboard, and he has some sketches that people have liked. So he makes a full-size tape drawing mm-hmm. using tape.
Actually using tape.
And makes a full-size outline of that, or he may make it into a full-size illustration. Mm-hmm. And the first information that the modeler gets may come from one of those either tape drawings or a full-size illustration. Mm-hmm. So normally a modeler will be working from this full-size tape drawing, and he gets his initial dimensions from that, or it may be taken back by an engineer and put on a layout, and he may be given a layout, or he may be given just offsets, which are dimensions mm-hmm. off of that drawing. And this is obtained by working from a fixed line, the dimension from that fixed line to where the outline of the vehicle would be. In other words, if you had a fixed line at 60 inches, you could come down and you could get all the dimensions from the hood and the roof, windshield and so forth, down the center of the car.
Mm-hmm.
And you could get a cross section, and you could get some idea of fenders and grille hood sections and so forth. And with some very rough information like that, you can start a model.
Mm-hmm.
So if you've got a center line, and you know you've got a front view, for instance, rear view, you know the sweep that the roof is expected to be, and the sweep, of course, as I mentioned earlier, the number one sweep is an eighth of an inch arc and 60 inches. So you might have a roof with a number seven sweep or something.
Mm-hmm.
So you can set the number seven sweep on this center line after you have the center line developed, and you create a surface out to the edge of the roof.
Are you speaking of adding this to a buck?
Yes.
Yes.
In clay.
Mm-hmm.
And you're setting this into clay.
Oh, the clay has already been applied.
The clay has been applied.
Okay, I'm sorry.
So when you apply the clay, when you establish a line, you build the clay up normally to your line. You mm-hmm. don't build the clay up and then cut down into it.
Right.
It's too hard.
Mm-hmm.
So you'll set points into the clay and then fill them so that you bridge from one point to the next
mm-hmm.
and clean the line up.
Mm-hmm.
And when you have a, for instance again, a center line, then you take a sweep and you work the other way, work
uh-huh.
across, and you yeah. set in a few sweeps, then you take what is called a battened, a wood battened, which is nothing more than perhaps a long maple wood strip that might be 3/16 thick by 2 inches by 48 inches, something like this.
Mm-hmm.
And with that, you start connecting these lines that you have, center line plus several cross lines. You protect those lines by laying on a steel tape or a steel band so that you can work down to these lines that you've developed in the surface and fill in between and smooth out in between in a rough form, at least, with a wood batten. And you do this on each of the surfaces. And you work out windshield surface by usually having a few sections. And you lay those in with templates. A template is a pattern. And you can get the pattern usually from a drawing, or you may be given some points and you can lay it out yourself. The modeler does this and may cut a template out of masonite or out of wood or out of plastic, depending on what he's doing. And you can set this template in with a bridge. If you have, say, two reference lines and the line itself, then you can locate this with a bridge. For instance, you might have, again, go back to the 60. You can have a template that it would have a 60-inch line in it. So you can set that up with a horizontal 60, whatever horizontal line you might have, and a fore and aft line, a vertical line. This tells you where the template goes fore and aft. And if it's, for instance, a template that's on a 15-inch line, or in metric now, if it's on the 400, why, you set it in it at that location. And you do this on both sides of the model. And after setting in a few of those, why, you work out that surface, for instance, windshield surface. And it takes time. It takes a lot of time to develop surface.
Well, I bet.
You develop the model in a rough state up to a good representation of what the tape drawing and the initial illustration was that the designer did. Of course, by the time you've reached that level, you have all sorts of people wanting to put their own ideas into it. Then you start getting the input and you start making your changes. But a model will develop this way, and of course now what happens, it's a little bit different in that you have the use of computer scanning and milling operations in some cases, but
it's taken some of the drudgery out of it.
It's taken some of the long, tedious work out of it, yes. It used to be that once you had a model completed and shown, and it was desired either to do further developments with it or to record it so that you could study it further, they would use the bridge to take points, and you would measure points off of that model and make templates off of the model also. And eventually they developed a system of cardboard template cutting. And this was a lightweight poster board that was used, and they had some people that were very skilled at making very quickly very accurate templates. Of course, in that case, you use the bridge to get positions, lines, horizontal and vertical or whatever, onto these cardboard templates. These were then given to the engineer, who used those to construct a drawing. Now, of course, the model goes to the scanner and is scanned, and a drawing is made automatically.
Is this an advance, do you think? In
well, yes, definitely. It's, yeah. It's a definite...
frees up,
it takes away the tedious work, the work which really isn't creative.
Right, yeah. Well, that's good.
Design work... is a creative task, and I've always felt should be used for that. And you need creative people to do the work, and when creative people have to do tedious work that is not creative, it sort of spoils the reason for them being there, mm-hmm. and it's non-productive, and is you know, it's not good.
Do you remember Willis P. Wagner at this period?
Well, yes, Wagner, I had understood, had made the drawings for the bridges,
mm-hmm.
and they were made in, like I mentioned, in two series. I think they made first the wooden bridges, the wooden rails, and aluminum. It was either an angle or a T-section. It could have been a T-section, and the wheels rolled on the vertical member of that T-section.
Mm-hmm.
And they functioned fairly well. The aluminum construction bridge was a step beyond that. And they were pretty good, except that the riveted structure, the rivets, of course, eventually wore.
Mm.
And the bridges got pretty loose, a lot of movement.
Mm.
So
they became less accurate.
They became less accurate.
But you used them pretty much through 1942.
Well,
I mean, those, up to 1942.
Oh, yes, those bridges were used, and of course, after the war, the design department became styling, and they were used to a greater extent. They set up separate studios.
Mm-hmm.
They hired a lot more people. And so the bridges were... overused, you might say, because they just didn't have enough bridges to do all the models they wanted to do.
Mm.
So about that time, they brought in some General Motors people, including Gordon A. and Snyder and Oswald, and they had an engineer. Can't remember his name offhand. And of course, the GM system did not utilize bridges, they utilized angles.
How's that different?
Well, the angle, you have rails, but the rails will have an edge for the angle to face up against.
Mm-hmm.
These were large angles that had a vertical column that would reach up to the roof of the car.
Mm-hmm.
So you'd work from with a scriber to scribe lines onto the model. You could work with scales to measure from off of those.
Mm-hmm.
Of course, you could set up two angles and clamp a straight edge across the two and measure down from that.
Make a sort of a crude bridge.
Make a crude bridge affair.
Mm-hmm.
These, of course, were moved manually from section to section. But it was slower. They can be very accurate, but the accuracy depends on the time taken to set them up, the angles, and also the care in which you take in setting in a point or measuring a point.
What, how do you suppose that GM, which prided itself on being fairly progressive, was really retrogressive in this regard?
Well, possibly. It was, it could have been, I don't know, it's a good question. It might revert back to Gregory's interest and knowledge and experience in boat building.
Mm-hmm.
Could have been.
Yeah. Uh-huh. And apparently, as he indicated, he got Willis Wagner interested, and Willis Wagner came up with the...
Yeah, I think Wagner had been educated as an architect.
Oh, that's right, yeah. So.
And therefore he understood construction of things, and he was very, very good man. Very always had a lot of good ideas. He'd be an ideal one to give that task to.
Mm-hmm. How long did it take General Motors to finally come around to bridges?
They never have.
They still don't have bridges.
Of course, we should get into that at a later time.
Oh, okay, just a side, yeah.
But. After the war, which is close to this period of time, there's a company developed a system of angles and crossbars and a few other things, one which they called a butterfly and a sliding member that they could use on these crossbars.
You're talking about GM now.
Yeah, and this system was evolved by a man. I should have my card file out here, shouldn't I? By the name of Norton, Fred Norton. And he had had a shop over on the east side. And I don't know just how he got into this. But he must have been into this maybe just before the war, or maybe during the war. Mm-hmm. And sold these various items to various ones in industry. Somebody must have first bought a set and thought, hey, this is great, and told everybody else, and everybody else started buying them, because eventually everyone else, all the other companies, including GM and Chrysler, and of course back in those times Packard and Studebaker and so forth, were using this other system. And even today Norton is still quite busy making angles. Some of the smaller angles, you take any modeling task, models that you'll do on a table, for instance, and the angle is an essential part of your work. So angles and cubes, scribers, so forth. So
what's that third term?
Scriber.
A scriber?
A straight edge that has a point and a flat surface, so you can go out and you can scribe an exact section on your model, horizontally or vertically, and from that section then you can either measure or set in a template or whatever.
But you're pretty high on the bridge, aren't you? You think that's the more sophisticated method, more accurate?
Well, yes. The thing that this has evolved into is something that still hasn't really happened, except in isolated cases, and that's a milling operations. You can, if you've got a line, we've developed milling tools that will cut that line right into clay. If you have a surface, you can mill surface into clay. So this again, anything that exists, that is in line or surface, can be done without the aid of a modeler up to a point. And it's a tool for the modeler to use and not something to replace the modeler. But again, it would relieve some of the tedious tasks that a modeler has to do.